Today is Monday, February 13th, 2023. This is part 10 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his last name M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty good, Tom. Thanks.
Good to hear it. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. In our last interview, you had talked pretty extensively about your interactions with photographer Ansel Adams. And the next thing we wanted to talk about was a pack trip you did in 1968 with some Mormon and Paiute elders. Can you recount that?
Yes, that was really turned out a significant and important trip to me. And it was the local cattlemen in Moccasin especially, and that's in the Paiute Reservation, and there's the Paiute town next to it. But they all ran their cattle out on the Arizona Strip, and then many of them historically took them down in the Grand Canyon for the winter. And a couple of them that I knew, because I was living in Moccasin then, were taking their livestock, it was the herd of cows and horses, down into Kanab Canyon and asked me if I wanted to go along, and well, they knew I did, so it was no problem. I really enjoyed it. I have a problem remembering if there were two trips. I kind of amassed it together in one big trip. But the one that was most interesting was when the fellows in Moccasin, it was mainly Owen Johnson, O-W-E-N, was one of the patriarchs there, and I lived next door, and he and his son and his cousin that were my age were going down there, so I really jumped at the chance to get more experience and hopefully get some pictures.
Hey, Alan.
Yeah.
Again, I'm going to ask you, there's some background rustling that just keeps going on. And it's hard to hear you because of that. Can we figure out what that is?
Yeah. There is a piece of paper on my desk that I was kind of doodling on, and that's not appropriate. I'll try not to.
We're picking up something. I'm not sure. I still hear it. I'm not sure what it is.
There shouldn't be anything right now.
It's definitely there. Now it's stopped. Now it's quiet.
Okay.
All right. Sorry.
I don't know what that would be.
It's nice and quiet now. If it comes up again, I'll ask you about it.
Yeah.
Sorry. I interrupted. You mentioned Owen Johnson and his son and cousin, and they were your age.
Well, Owen Johnson was, in his probably 50s, 60s back then.
Okay.
He was the patriarch, and his son, David, and then David's cousin, Mel, M-E-L, Mel Heaton, H-E-A-T-O-N, were good friends there. Mel had worked at Pipe Springs where I had, and kind of instrumental in getting me to move up to Moccasin, and that worked out really well for me.
There's that. Hey, I'm sorry, Alan. There's that noise again. It's just like a scraping or a clunking, moving around, and I'm not sure what it is, but it's loud, and I hear it on my end.
Why? Let's see. Because this is the way we did it before. I've had some problems with my phone and Bluetooth and everything the last few weeks, and I don't know what the difference would be.
Huh. I'm not sure either, but I'm definitely picking up some very interesting background sound.
Huh.
Now it's stopped. And now it's quiet.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. We'll keep working on it and see if we can figure out what it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to. Well, technology is quite a difficult problem sometimes.
Yes, it is.
We have to be really patient to keep ahead of what's happening and our equipment going. But I'll try to.
Are you wearing an earbud in your ear?
I have my hearing aids, which the telephone comes through there by Bluetooth, and that's really the only way I can hear the telephone. So, and that's the way it's been all the other times, but I'm trying to think of what I've done differently here.
Right. It's almost like we're picking up maybe your shirt collar on your neck, or there's some sort of noise that's coming in.
I'm sorry about that, because I.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. Am I coming? Can you hear my volume okay now?
I hear your voice just fine.
Okay.
It's just that the background, this rustling, comes and goes. Now it's nice and quiet.
Huh. Wow.
Well, let's.
To just sit
yeah. Maybe
I don't
so.
Know what that could be, because I don't.
Gosh.
Hear it myself.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Something's
on the technology here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's do what we can here. Mel Heaton, Heaton, is a cousin of Owen Johnson.
His son David. So he would be a nephew.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Nephew of Owen, and Mel worked at Pipe Springs.
Right. One of the summers, and he was best friend there as I stayed in that area, and I can just describe the trip was to take a small herd of horses and maybe a couple cows. I recall it mainly horses, but down Kanab Canyon and up onto the Esplanade, top of the Supai, on the right west side of Kanab, and going around to the head of Scotty's Canyon, and leaving the herd there for the winter. And the stock was owned by Orville Palmer, O-R-V-A-L Palmer, from Alton, Utah, A-L-T-O-N. he was related to the Heatons. There are Heatons in Alton and Kanab and Moccasin, all related. But
okay.
He, at this time, had the herd of, well, he had the, I was going to say he had the grazing permit there. I think he did, if they had figured it from his mother to him. But he, to my knowledge, was the last one to actually graze livestock down in the lower Kanab Canyon out on the Esplanade. But at that same time, you were saying last time that what's his name that lived up by Mount Trumbull? I had a, you know, a 50-mile spring.
Right, that was Al Craig.
Al Craig, yeah. You were mentioning that he still had some cattle in there, that was an active cow camp.
In 150 mile, that's others, right.
So
yeah, yeah. But they were all on the way out.
Yeah, yeah. They all the permits were just lifetime tenancy until the permittee died. The was revert to the government, BLM, and then to the Park Service ultimately, and they would remove, not have any more grazing there was the idea. But so this, they knew the writing was on the wall, because the others up and down the canyon, the permits had been terminated, you might say, with the older people. And somehow, and I don't think I was the one that instigated it, but I certainly supported it, was that, I think it was Owen Johnson, the idea of this fact trip, they invited two of the older Paiute cowboys that ran cattle in the area and had worked for other cattlemen and were very familiar with Kanab Canyon there, and invited them to come along, and then had the, and Owen did this so they and he could find the old trails and show the younger generation, meaning me and David and Owen, where they were, because it was obvious that these trails might disappear if no one knew where they were, where they had been, and the stories. So I jumped at the chance.
Wow.
To go along. And we went down up on the Esplanade, as I say. We went around and camped at the upper Scotty's Canyon Spring, and then moved and rode down to the point overlooking the confluence of Kanab Creek and the Colorado from the, on the west side. And then it took them a while, you know, of riding back and forth and back and talking a lot, but they found out where the trail went from the Esplanade down to the top of the Red Wall. And so we, you know, we had pack animals and horses, and we got everything down there, and then turned and rode back up the west side of Kanab Canyon on the top of the Red Wall.
Okay.
And we actually stopped and camped again by coincidence, mainly because that's where we ended up. But there was water in the Scotties Canyon where you cross it up there at the Red Wall level. It's kind of even a slot canyon down in there. But, and then we came back up and out Kanab Canyon. And it was a really interesting trip to me because they talked and found all the old pothole water holes out on the rim that they had known before. And we went and saw them and used the water from them. And they just kind of, they really enjoyed the fact to have one last horse trip into the Grand Canyon down there. Because they have not been in the two Paiute elders. And, I don't know, but one was a dry, D-R-Y-E, and the other was, I'll think of it. It was on the tip of my tongue, but I'm trying to think of what the Paiute elders were. And because it had been 10 or 15 years since they had been down in the canyon, and they considered this a real treasure for them to go and see the country again, to relive what they had done, where they had camped, trails they had built, and all of that. So it was a good experience. And my main question at the time to myself was, so what? I've got this information. What can be done with it? Who can have it? How is it going to save the trails in the canyon? And I never really felt that I adequately did anything to follow up on that. But then the bottom line is that backpackers like you found all those routes yourself, and that part of the canyon now is visited a lot more than I thought it would ever be.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely. The Paiute elder you mentioned, Bry, is that B as in boy, R-Y-E, or D as in David?
As in David, D-R-Y-E.
Thank you.
And, yeah, I'll think of the other one that was there.
Do you remember any stories that they told?
Well, it was just basically talking about, where we followed the routes and went, and they just had comments about, we camped here, someone else camped, we camped over there on another trip, and we brought so-and-so's cows in, and or took some out, or it was more, there wasn't a lot of sitting down and telling stories. I wish it had been now, but it was just their enjoying their, they were really, really happy to be there. That's what
nice.
I can
nice.
Say. That's what affected me.
Did you come in via Hack Canyon?
Yes. And actually came in out on the drive out on the point on the, be the northwest corner of the junction of Hack and Kanab Canyon.
Okay.
And from there, was a major horse cattle trail down to the Hack Canyon Spring down below.
Got it.
And we went through. It was a lot easier. I don't think the road down to the mine was really passable back then.
Okay.
Occasionally it was. I don't know if the local cattlemen and the uranium miners got along too well, because I was never encouraged to drive down to the uranium mine and hike from there.
Hmm. Okay.
And I know they never went that way with the cattle. So I think it was more that it was unreliable after the winter rains and some summer storms to get down Hack Canyon.
Okay.
But it was easy to get out on the rim and go down off the point.
Right. Okay. And that makes sense. What do you remember about Owen Johnson?
He was a really great person. I felt lucky to know him, and I ended up living next door to him in a little cottage that he had built for his mother to live out her last few years. And he was a very important, of course, he was the bishop there at the Mormon Church for quite a few years, but his job was the Arizona brand inspector for everything the Arizona Strip west or east of Mount Trumbull, mainly.
Wow, okay.
And the brand inspector in that area of the Arizona Strip in southern Utah, and, well, all over, but there especially, that was one of the most respected people in the country. They had to be totally honest, have a really good reputation for fairness, and they also, and I put John Riffey in the same category of dealing with the cattlemen and trying to keep them honest. You know, there was still a lot of hostility against the state and the BLM, especially in times that they were trying to enforce the restrictions and limits of grazing, and it was a difficult time early on, but Owen was just a really, really good person who helped me a lot, told me a lot about the history of the area up there, and was really friendly, and his wife also, and he was a good man.
Nice.
And when I'm mentioning that, I'll have to mention the other, in each of the communities up there, probably in the town, because it's like Fredonia and Kanab, and especially Moccasin, the cattlemen all lived in the town. And they ran their cattle out 20, 30 miles away, out on the, and they had huge ranges that they grazed their cattle on. But nobody had their ranch houses out in the country. They all lived in town. So the town functioning was really important. And in Fredonia, when we moved there, my wife had lived with one of the leaders of that community, probably the most important one in Sedalia, because he had been a bishop before, but his main, he worked at the sawmill, but his main job was the water master. And the water master in any of those towns, it was elected somehow, but he was always re-elected. But see, and like Fredonia, the water came from a set of springs up in southern Utah called Water Canyon, one of 100 water canyons. But and then it came in a series of ditches and pipes maybe 5 miles down to the town. And then it was divided all through every lot in the town.
Oh, wow.
Got its share of the water.
Okay.
On little irrigation ditches. And some of them just going down the gutters or the streets. And there are lots of towns in Arizona now and Utah that still irrigate the lands, the lots, through this irrigation system. But
what was his name?
To avoid any problems, you always had a water master who, if necessary, would go around and close off the place in the ditch to divert the water into your lot, to water your vegetable garden and hay or whatever you grew, and open up the, he would close off the stop the water coming into your neighbor's yard and turn it into yours.
Got it.
And he knew where there was people that got along really well and families and were very serious about it, and they just did it themselves, went out and took the water and closed it off and used their share because it was kind. You got 2 hours worth of water, and if it was a drought, you didn't get much water, but you got your share.
Right.
And but there were people that you know, always tried to get a little more than their share, to the extent that when complaints would come in, the water master would resolve it and, if necessary, open and close it himself. And at Moccasin, there were the springs there, and they didn't have a specific water master, but everyone knew when their share was coming down, to because everyone had large fields of alfalfa there that they grew for their livestock. And Owen Johnson was that, and also the important livestock brand inspector.
Who was the water master at Fredonia?
Well, that was Alan Judd.
J-U-D-D?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm thinking about the last name Johnson, and I'm thinking about the Johnsons at Lee's Ferry. Were they related?
Yeah. Owen Johnson was raised as a boy at the Ferry of Lonely Dell Ranch.
Wow.
And that's when I say he told me the history. He really wanted me to understand that history and what went on there, because John D. Lee got all the publicity.
Right.
And Owen's grandfather, Warren Johnson, he was came before Lee left, but he and his family stayed there for 18 years
right.
on the ferry.
Right.
And his Warren's son, Carl, was Owen's dad. And if you go to Lee's Ferry, the Johnson Cabin, the log cabin that's there by the on the ranch, Owen was remembers being raised in there as a child.
Wow, cool.
And he, you know, felt that that needed more information, more appreciation, needed to be appreciated more, that the value of the Johnsons down at Lee's Ferry, that the ferry didn't run itself.
Right.
So before I went to Lee's Ferry at all, I had a very, very strong sense of the history of the place.
Okay.
And all, so,
nice.
But that was good. And as I mentioned, I know I went at least two trips down into Kanab Canyon with taking the horses and cattle into the grazing there. And in later years, the permit was, you know, they don't do that anymore. It was gone.
So the permit was eventually retired then?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that makes me think that Orville Palmer, who became a really close friend of ours, he lived in Elkin, Utah, from a very old, you know, Mormon family. And he, I'm sure it was his mother that had that permit, because when she passed, he, you know, couldn't go in there anymore.
Okay. And then, what do you remember about Mel Heaton?
Okay. He was really a good friend.
Okay.
And really taught me everything I needed to know about horses and packing, and took the time. He was a really good friend, because he was the best man at my wedding.
Oh, my.
And then in later years, he got married and got a bunch of kids, and I got married, and we moved to Sedonia and got busy. And it's the case with a lot of young couples, you move away, think it's going to last forever, but it doesn't. You just get busy and
right.
So many things that, and then we moved over to, well, I went to the Tucson, to the U of A, and then we moved to Page, and occasionally would see him and hear about him and all of that. But he's actually a very interesting person, and if you could find a way to interview him, he could supply a lot of interesting information. I think he was a maintenance helper at Pipe Springs when I was there for the Park Service, and at this time we're talking about, and he really helped me out a lot. He had a lot of ideas very outgoing, and he really kept talking about his dream of eventually having a pack, a horse outfit that would take river runners off the river on the north side and fly them out of the canyon. And he definitely had researched it a lot. He knew that a lot of the river people. And I'm trying to think right now what the sequence was, because one of the, probably the next summer, he was a summer park ranger at Phantom Ranch.
Huh.
And he got to know all the river runners there because he was contacting them. And he would ask them all, and several of them said, yeah, we'd like to have a trip where we could take people off the river down below Lava Falls, which would be Whitmore. And long story short, we decided, he and I, and with David's assistance too, decided to, well, set up a company to do that, see if we could do it, to really research it. And we, I can just mention that previous to that, you could drive a Jeep down to the rim right above the river in the inner gorge at the top of that big lava cliff.
Right, the top of the Whitmore Trail.
Yeah. And there, and we went in there by four-wheel drive and checked things out. It was very, very rough.
Mm.
But after the Second World War, there were all these guys had motorboats going up the river from Lake Mead, and trying to get through the Grand Canyon, and they did successfully, and then they'd come back down in these wooden motorboats. I don't know if you're familiar with all of that.
Yes.
Yeah, and at Whitmore, the guys that were doing the motorboats, they figured out there was a way there, and they brought in, I don't know if they really put up a tank or they just had gas cans, but they ran a hose, which was more like a garden hose. They didn't have plastic pipes like later, from the top of that rim down to the river to provide fuel to these motorboats.
Right.
And there was a way that you could hike up and down. It was accessible route. You could work your way down to the river from the end of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we decided to do the takeout. And we talked to all the Bundys, got their approval, because even though they had no claim to anything there, you definitely wanted them on your side when you were going to be working down in there.
Right. I think that was Chet, C-H-E-T, or Chester, Chet Bundy's operation there to fuel those trips.
Yeah. And that, see, when we got there, that had not been used for long time.
Okay.
Years. This would have been in the late 60s, so I doubt if it was 10 years since it had been there. I think there was, parts of the pipe here and there down the cliff, but and the road some people would just drive out to see the view.
Okay.
It was really, really rough to get there.
Yeah.
But anyway, we got commitments from two or three of the river companies, Western River, which was in Fredonia then, and Hatch, and I think one other. Don't know which it would have been. one of them that combined and doesn't exist anymore. But anyway, we then went around to Boulder City to Lake Mead National Recreation Area and got a concession permit to take visitors from the raft, river runners, up to the top of the trail there and drive them out to Wawweep out there in the flats. That's all the it was Lake Mead Recreation Area there.
Right, right.
And it was just, you know, looking down on it, it looked like a quarter mile. That's probably what it was.
Mm-hmm.
On it. But, and then we actually bought a road blader. And, you know, I'm embarrassed that we bulldozed the road down there, but no, we didn't. We just moved big rocks here and there, filled in a little here and there, and a lot of handwork made it passable to get from the rim up to the valley there, where we put in an airstrip.
Okay, so hang on a second. At this time, today, the Bar 10 Ranch is a big ranch there at the north end of that airstrip. When you were doing this, when you worked on the road improvement and put in the airport, the runway, was that ranch there at all?
No.
Okay.
No, nothing. What was there, which was what made it relatively feasible, was that actually it was owned by a dentist, I think, in Scottsdale that named Webb, because we called it the Webb's Ranch. And he owned a spring up on the mountains above that area,
right,
quite a ways away. And he had the cattleman before him, and I don't think it was the Bundys, but someone had, you know, put a pipe and piped the water down to the Webb's Ranch, and there were three water stock pond tanks. They were round metal, galvanized metal tanks with a faucet, and going for about a mile or so along the side of, well, we put the airstrip next to that. There was no airstrip there. There was a little one-room line cabin at what became the ranch up there.
Okay.
The road from Bundyville down to the head of that was very rough, and we did spend more time improving that road.
Okay.
But it's really kind of bizarre to me that I ended up with a Park Service concession and my name was on the airstrip. But because it was private and it was registered with the FAA and was listed as a private airstrip, and my name was on it, and I got a permit from the BLM to put in the airstrips there.
Okay.
So, you know, this was, to me, a big deal. I wasn't prepared for anything like this. I just wanted to take pictures and hike. I was doing this. And
my gosh.
And then and the idea.
So, Alan, hang on a second. Alan, hang on. I'm going to ask you about the airstrip. So, you guys, where did you get the road grader from?
Oh, it was an old derelict thing that somebody up in Kanab or Fredonia had, and there was one of the guys from, actually it was the teacher in Moccasin's one-room schoolhouse. Her husband was kind of retired, and he had been a heavy equipment operator, and he, when he heard what we were talking about, he said, oh, I'll find a old lighter for you.
Okay.
And so we drove it from Moccasin all the way down to Whitmore.
So was this like a six-wheel road grader, or was this sort of a four-wheel thing that you drug along behind a tractor?
Oh, no. This was a big yellow.
Oh, okay.
That road grader.
Okay.
A blade, you know.
Yeah.
And fortunately, he was a great mechanic, and he loved doing it because no one else could keep that thing running. He had taken it apart and put it together, and he loved it. And so he was down there. And turned out when he got there, he really knew what to do and how to use it right.
Okay.
So we were lucky on that.
So he bladed it out.
Yeah.
What was his name? Do you remember?
Last name was Clayson. Clayson.
Clayson.
Son. Clayson. Clayson.
Thank you.
Yeah. I might think of his first name, but.
Okay.
And I remember one of my bizarre experiences in it. I think we took the blade out, and he used it other places and was able to, you know, get a little work with it. Our idea was just to sell it when we were done with it. But I know he brought it back in, and we did some more work with it. But I don't know if you've ever driven from, like, Mount Trumbull to Bundyville itself.
Yes. Yes.
And then you go a little further west and then directly south to Whitmore.
Yes.
And it may be 10 miles there. There's a big kind of almost a lake bed of just mud and dirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, that long one there. Well, we were down in there, and I had a four-wheel drive pickup, an old Ford, and we had worked. We came out, and we had a job we had to get done down there, but the storm came through. And when we got out on top, it was just axle deep in mud across there. And Clayson says, and he wanted to get home too. This was in the evening, late afternoon. He wanted to get home. I wanted to get home.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, I can drag, we can put a chain on the truck in the back, and I can drag it through this swamp, and I think everything will be fine. So we did, and I was in the truck, and he revs it up, and I revved it up, and we hit that lake bed mud mess, and all I saw was this huge wave of mud coming up over the top of the truck.
Oh, my.
And, you know, he didn't stop, fortunately, because in a while, you know, I could tell we were still going, and we got across the mud, and he came around all right, and we figured out a way to clean off the windshield of the truck so I could see something, because it was covered.
Wow.
It wasn't just muddy, it had 2 inches of mud on the whole thing.
Wow.
And so the truck still ran, it was okay, and so we headed on up by Mount Trumbull, and it got dark by then, because this whole operation took quite a while.
Mm.
And we went by Al and Mary Craig's, and their light was on. Well, they had, you know, a lantern inside. We could tell they were up in there, so I always stopped in there just to say hello and tell them what we're doing, and they were always interested in where we were going and what we were doing.
Uh-huh.
Here comes this blade and this, you know, mud ball truck. And we said, you know, we just wanted you to know who it was going through here in the after dark.
Nice.
So they were interested, and Mary just said, you're not going any further than that. You got to spend the night.
Oh.
And so we ended up, they served something for dinner or breakfast or something, and we went up in the attic, and they had a bunch of beds there, probably where the girls had grown up in the, you know, when they lived out there. And because we were not dirty, or we took our boots off,
right,
to go inside,
right.
But
Alan, what,
yeah,
what vehicle was Clayson driving? Was he driving the big motor grader? Is that what he towed,
yeah,
you through the mud with?
He was driving the motor grader.
Okay.
And I was following.
Got it.
So, you know, they were interested in who was driving the motor grader by after dark. So we knew we had to go in there.
Right.
We didn't expect to get dinner and spend the night. And the next morning, of course, we got a big breakfast, and then off we went, and I got back to Moccasin without problems, and other than I couldn't hide the what the tale I told was they had to believe me.
So was the idea to take river runners, put them on livestock, and take them up the Whitmore Trail, and then put them in vehicles and take them to the airport and then fly them somewhere?
To St. George.
Fly them to St. George.
Yeah, and there was a pilot in Kanab that I had known and was very receptive to this idea, and he planned to, you know, come over and land there and ferry the people up to St. George and then go back to Kanab.
So he wouldn't fly them to Marble Canyon, back to Lee's Ferry, and he wouldn't fly them to Las Vegas like they do today. He was flying them to St. George.
Right. And that was, you know, where the both companies really wanted them to take, you know, they advertised that.
Were there connections to fly onward from St. George, or would people get the bus to Vegas, or?
Well, there were. There was a pilot there that would take people wherever they wanted from there, a bigger plane.
Oh, okay.
And so we had a carried about 8 or 10 people, and we'd, you know, go up to the airport. We did that about 2 years.
Okay.
Or I did, and I ended up kind of doing it by myself, and my wife and I would do that, and and the problem was that first it was really hot down there.
Yep.
In the summer, and I camped on the rim, the bottom rim there, because I had to take the string of horses every day down to the river to drink and to come back up to the corral on top.
Okay.
And that, you know, it's fine, but a week of 110 degrees is hard on your body.
Yeah.
So that was one of the hard things. The second difficult thing was that we had no communication. This was before satellite phones, before radio phones, before definitely no cell phones. But we were isolated there. The boatmen were told what time they were, or they told us we're going to get to the thing there at 2 o'clock. And I was there with all the livestock at 2 o'clock, and they pilot was ready, and too often, especially with the hatch group, I'll have to mention, they wouldn't show up. And they'd be hours and hours late. And it was very difficult, and was probably the main reason why we just didn't do it a third year.
Right, you'd be down there baking super hot down at the river, and no one would be showing up to get out.
Right, right. There was one trip that you might, you may have heard rumors of the hatch trip where the last night, or actually on all the nights, the crew was, well, just completely drunk. And in the morning, the group, they knew they were leaving with us. They finally made breakfast, got everything cleaned up, the passengers, got the boat ready, and then just really spent hours trying to get the boatmen sober enough that they could continue down the river. And they'd arrive a couple hours late, very upset, very peeved at the boat company, not happy campers to, you know, because what was I just, fortunately, the guy with the plane would fly over and he'd see that there was nobody down, that I was down at the river with the horses and there was no boat, no people. And he'd go back to Kanab and then come back and then come back. And so it wasn't very, it didn't work because of the, some of the boatmen not really appreciating what was happening.
You know, Alan, today the boats all run lava and they camp in a line, more or less camp after camp after camp, above the Whitmore helipad, and the helicopter flies them in and out early in the morning.
Right.
And it would have made sense to keep you from getting cooked with your horses, to do the same thing. Have them run lava, camp below there, and then come down to you early in the morning. Now, that wouldn't have worked
that was
if... Oh, it was. Okay.
Yeah. They were planning to be there like, you know, 8 or 9 o'clock, but they wouldn't get there till 1 in the afternoon.
Oh, my. Okay.
And, you know, it just, it was after the fact when I get out and complain about it was a couple days later.
Right.
Like, so there was no helipad there. I would say that the private trips coming down the river back in that day, which was, I guess we would call it back then the hippie central, it just, that was an experience. It was very entertaining to have the private trips go by when we were waiting on the beach there. But
okay.
That was just funny and different. But also there was one time when Georgie White, her group, we did not take hers out, but they came by really shook enough because they went through Lava Falls and she had the three pontoons tied together
right.
side to side.
Right.
And it went over the falls and the three layers just folded in. So it was stacked three high with all the people in between.
Right.
It's the way, and they're all, no one was seriously hurt, but they, you know, we would always shake our heads. Like,
so she would actually, that's called the Georgie sandwich.
Yeah.
And they were unable to actually unfold the sandwich after making their run?
Well, after the run, they did.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Everything was all mixed up. People were mixed up. They were, you know, they would pull in, and if they did stop, I, you know, they were definitely checking their bruises. So, but I definitely, as you know, experienced groups that really happened to.
Okay.
But we, I just, you know, I basically decided that no, I just can't do that. It was hard to get people. It was so complicated and mainly no communication.
Okay.
We had thought of radio towers, but you couldn't get them up on the rim in the wilderness. So we just sold the van to the Bundys and they took it over. I don't think they took many trips out, maybe just a couple. And a couple of years later, I heard that Tony Heaton had set up an operation where he was helicoptering off the Wallapai side up to the ranch and had a little development there that people could stay in and fly out of there by fixed land, which was a great idea. You know, it worked 5 years later. It didn't work for us.
Right. So I'm curious, just thinking out loud here, given today that we have satellite phones and all kinds of connectivity, and given today that the boats all run Lava Falls and then, like say, park just above Whitmore to do their exchange, do you think that the concept of pulling people out by pack stock versus helicopters could work?
I'd have to say the helicopters, mainly because the horses and pack stock, you'd have to build eventually a shaded place at the rim there and have to get really some way of getting the water to that corral.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And then a couple buses, going from the rim to the airport, that wasn't too bad. We spent a lot of time on that road just by hand and rolling rocks and getting it passable, but it took a couple hours. They all did it, and it was kind of an adventure, but, you know, riding a mule even for half hour, 40 minutes up the trail there, and 100 and plus with the black lava rock.
Right.
It was hard on people. And it sounded neat that you could get on a horse and go up there.
Uh-huh.
But it isn't like coming out the South Rim.
Right.
Where this one, it goes through an immense amount of labor to get the people up. For, like I say, a half hour.
Right. And these days, when there's I don't know, 4 or 5, maybe 6 river trips that are pulling people out, each trip has 25 people.
Right.
To do that and by stock. How many people were you taking out at a time? What was the biggest group you took out?
Probably 12 people.
Okay.
And that would be 2 plane loads going wherever.
Okay.
Right.
And if there was one pilot with one plane, those people would have to wait. Half of them would have to wait while the plane flew away and then flew back.
Right. Fortunately, the stock ponds in the galvanized steel ring there was very great. I would get in it immediately and just sit in there for the time and so at all the people. So that was kind of fun. And the interesting thing is that I really don't know Tony, didn't know Tony Heaton. My wife and I were at Moccasin, they had left. His wife had been a home ec teacher at Fredonia, and my wife took the position a year later as the home ec teacher. So we knew of them. But they had been in St. George, and Tony Heaton's related to Mel Heaton, the first or second cousin.
Okay.
But he was raised in St. George, where the freeway goes through now. It goes right through their old ranch.
Oh, wow.
Huge barn and a lot of outbuildings and corrals and all of that. But we had already moved on when we found this list. So he's got that permit and is taking people out by helicopter, and they're great, but I never went back.
Okay.
Mainly because I was just busy doing other things.
Yeah. Okay. Alan, maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history series. We've been talking for a little over an hour here.
An hour.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to the material we've just covered?
No. If I think of something, I'll make note of it.
Okay.
just remember what I remember and forget what I forget.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's what it is. Okay, well, with that then, this will conclude part 10 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Monday, February 13th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.